Welcome to Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Alexander Drillon, and to begin, he presented a patient from his practice.
This is a 45-year-old Asian never smoker who is a young female who's an assistant at a dermatology clinic. She had presented in spring of 2013 with symptoms of increasing cough and shortness of breath. She had gone to a local emergency department where an X-ray was performed showing a large pleural effusion. And as part of her subsequent workup, she had a CAT scan and a PET scan, which showed multifocal hypermetabolic disease in the pleura and also lymphadenopathy in the right hilar, the right cervical, and gastrohepatic lymph node. So clearly metastatic disease. She initially had a thoracentesis, and the cytology was suspicious for non-small cell lung carcinoma, and then subsequently underwent a VAT where they did both a biopsy of a pleural metastasis and also placement of Plurex. And so the pathology from that returned positive for a lung adenocarcinoma, and that was called based on the immunohistochemical stains, which were negative for P40, but positive for TTF1 and napsin.
So before you go on, I'm kind of curious. I mean, you're at a tertiary center, but if a patient like this were to present in a community-based setting, what do you consider the minimum that would need to be done in terms of testing of the tumor? I mean, obviously, she's going to get ALK and EGFR and ROS1. What other assays do you consider standard? And do you think that multiplex testing in a patient like in a non-smoker should be standard in a community setting?
Absolutely. So I think this is a good juncture to talk about a paper that we published in Clinical Cancer Research. And the premise of this paper was trying to figure out how good next-generation sequencing is as a clinical test. And the way we went about the question was we had taken people who had had testing at our institution, so Memorial Sloan Kettering, via our former algorithm of non-NGS or next-generation sequencing tests. And this is a little bit of a walk through history, actually, of molecular profiling in lung cancer. So we had looked at the old algorithm, which interrogated 11 different genes via a number of tests. So in the past, you had a one gene, one test type of strategy where you did Sanger for EGFR or FISH for ALK. That then migrated over towards more multiplex tests like Snapshot or Sequenom, which are essentially hotspot mutational testing platforms that look at a defined number of genes and certain mutations that have been described as potential contributors to oncogenesis in those genes. And so we had looked at patients who had testing that was negative via those old or former tests at our institution. So three FISH tests for ALK, ROS1, and RET, the sequenome assay, a sizing assay, and also Sanger sequencing. So essentially, they were negative for the usual suspects, including EGFR, ALK, BRAF, KRAS, RET, and ROS1.
I guess we should point out that this was all adenocarcinoma in either non-smokers or less than 15-pack years?
Right. So, yeah, that's an important point, especially since this was a very unique population that we had chosen with the intent of trying to enrich the eventual results for potential drivers. However, I think that the results of this paper overall are applicable to patients who have a history of smoking and who have varied clinical features, not even just lung adenocarcinomas, but also squamous cell carcinomas and potentially other cancers of the lung like small cell. And so those people had quote-unquote pan-negative disease. And pan-negative is really sort of a moving target and is one of the conclusions that we made at the end of this endeavor. And we had sent their tumor tissue for next-generation sequencing via the Foundation One platform, or the platform of Foundation Medicine. And it was interesting that about 94% of patients who had quote-unquote pan-negative disease, there was something that was picked up on NGS. Now, that's a testament to a few things. First, the fact that lung cancers are very complex, and there's a paper published showing that non-small cell lung cancer, adenos, and squamous cell lung cancers come in as sort of a close second to melanomas in terms of complexity. But it also brings up another challenge for people in the clinic. These reports come back and you have a variety of different abnormalities, fusions, copy number changes, mutations. And really, there needs to be a lot of guidance provided to the clinician as to which of these alterations are potentially actionable. And for which of these alterations, there might be targeted therapies that are either approved or available on protocols. And I will mention that Foundation Medicine has done a good job of annotating the report so that there is some information provided in the report that the physician eventually receives. So that's the first piece. The second result from this was, despite the fact that 94% had something in their quote-unquote pan-negative lung cancers, in one out of four patients, or roughly one out of four patients, there was a driver that was missed by the previous non-NGS tests. So these were an EGFR mutation, several fusions, including ALK, RET, and ROS1, that the previous testing would have supposedly picked up, but for various reasons didn't. And it's hard to explain why exactly those drivers weren't caught. And you might speculate that it could do with the sensitivity of the test. It could also do with the purity of the sample that you get. A lot of these, for example, are very small biopsies that you get off patients with metastatic disease. But suffice to say, NGS picked up a driver in one out of four for which there was an FDA-approved targeted therapy or a targeted therapy listed in the NCCN lung cancer guidelines. And we were actually able to get a fraction of these patients to targeted therapy, and they responded.
So let's pick out on this a little bit. I see here that there was at least one patient I see who had some type of EGFR mutation. It says G719A, which is not, I guess, one of the common ones. For example, what is that?
Yeah, so it's a less common EGFR mutation, but has been described as a sensitizing mutation to EGFR TKI therapy.
And that's not picked up on a typical EGFR with IHC?
Well, not on a typical sequenome platform, for example, unless you specifically interrogate for it.
In terms of the other, so I see there's BRAF, as you said, ROS, ALK, RET, all these things. Interesting that they were missed on the initial test. But are there other mutations? Because, you know, a lot of times these reports, you look at them and they talk about things like you've never heard of.
Right.
Sometimes there's a trial, but it's kind of obscure as to whether it really seems like it would be likely that a patient would benefit. Outside of picking up these mutations that were missed, are there completely new mutations we're not testing for that you would consider targetable?
So this brings us to the last bit of the paper, where about another 40% of patients had a genomic alteration that was detected that wasn't detected by the previous non-NGS tests. And you'll see in the paper that we listed these various alterations only if there was an appropriate clinical trial of a targeted therapy that was matched to the target that we found. I guess the question that you're asking also has to do with the element of discovery. So is it possible that we might discover, apart from these gene changes that have already been in the literature, new changes that might be actionable on a clinical level? And that's certainly possible because next-generation sequencing tests, unlike the old tests which zoom in on changes which have already been described or published, really sequence the entire length of the gene. And so you're poised to pick up these novel changes, granted that the frequency of those would probably be very low.
It kind of seems like you're thinking maybe that oncologists in general practice should be using some kind of next-generation sequence testing, and a patient is presenting with metastatic disease. Certainly a non-smoker with adenocarcinoma, it sounds like that's what you'd go for. Is that right? Is that what you're saying to a general doc?
Absolutely. So for someone out in the community, I would absolutely recommend next-generation sequencing over piecemeal testing. That's because, one, you're able to identify many more clinically actionable genomic alterations for which targeted therapies are either approved or are in testing. And second, another layer that we haven't addressed was there's a huge biopsy load that is seen in patients who undergo these multiple piecemeal non-NGS tests. So if you look at the paper that we published, essentially two-thirds of people required multiple biopsies, and the median number of biopsies to get this whole round of testing completed was 3.
Wow.
And the range went from 2 to 6, so there are some people that underwent multiple procedures to secure tissue.
I mean, a typical core biopsy, is that enough?
It depends on the amount of tumor that's in the tissue. So I would say that if you're an oncologist and you get asked by an interventional radiologist or a pulmonologist, what's a safe number of cores to get if it's feasible? I usually would recommend something like 2 to 3 cores if that's possible. Often if it's a very cellular biopsy, 1 core will do. And really all you're looking for is a good amount of DNA. And for some assays, that's about 100 nanograms, or in terms of slides, which is really the currency of tissue in the clinic, that amounts to something like 10 to 15 unstained slides.
So I'm going to guess it sounds like you're saying you would also recommend this approach to a patient who's a smoker with a non-squamous tumor.
Yes, absolutely. We know that there is an enrichment in never smokers for some drivers. However, there are, for example, some BRAF mutations which occur in smokers, which do have targeted therapies that are either approved for other indications or being explored in clinical trials.
But I mean, just in terms of numbers, the number that stuck in my mind, what you said was the, you know, 1 in 4 chance of having a real targetable lesion found that was otherwise missed. What would that number be in somebody who's, let's say, a current smoker with a non-squamous cancer?
The number would probably be lower. I don't have a good estimate of that. Suffice to say that I think that the endeavor is still worth it, because if you find one of these targets, you know, the amount of time you're able to buy some of these patients with targeted therapies can be substantial.
So again, it sounds like you're making the same suggestion to squamous. I sort of wonder, I mean, what's the likelihood of finding a targetable mutation nowadays in squamous cell? I mean, putting aside PD-1, for example.
Yeah, so we did do a review in Lancet Oncology and squamous cell lung cancers, and there are several actionable alterations in squames. So in about 1 out of 5 patients, you see an FGFR1 amplification, and there are clinical trials of FGFR inhibitors. These are being explored. There are also several mutations, such as mutations in PIK3CA or P10, or AKT, which are enriched in squamous cell lung cancers. There are DDR2 mutations for which dasatinib has been described as a potential drug to use. So yes, there are subsets of squamous cell lung cancers for which target therapies may be available.
So, you know, all these targets that you just talked about, you see on these reports, I mean, have patients been reported who had responses with those targets? You know, FGFR, I've heard a lot about. I don't think I've heard of any responses.
So the data that we have in this arena is really young. So for FGFR, the BGJ drug, there have been responses reported in a phase 1 setting. There are other drugs that are being explored as well. There have also been a published response of a patient with a DDR2 mutation that responded to a dasatinib combination. And I think that as we dive into how to target these tumors, we're going to see the number of these responses increase.
So getting back to this lady, so she, because she was under your care, had what, Foundation 1?
She did. So she had a panoply of non-NGS tests. Eventually, it was sent to Foundation 1, and a RET rearrangement was identified.
So no EGFR, no ALK,
yep.
But RET.
Previous testing was negative for EGFR mutation, KRAS mutation, and ALK and ROS1 FISH were negative.
So when you say previous testing, did you all do that, or was that before she got to you?
That was done by the community doctor.
At your place, because I'm sure those tests would come back quicker. Do you do both? Do you send it for next-gen sequencing and these other assays too to get a quick answer?
So we tend to send these samples solely for next-generation sequencing unless you have a patient that's very symptomatic of their disease. And that is one of the conundrums that we have to face with these next generation tests. It's wonderful that we have one huge test to capture 200 to 400 different genes, but the turnaround time for next generation sequencing, at least at our institution, for a clinical read to come back is about 4 weeks. Now, if you have someone who's a young, never smoker, where you're really suspicious that there may be an EGFR mutation or an ALK fusion lurking there, it is possible to do tests that have a very quick turnaround time. So what we've done at our institution is we pick up the phone and call the pathologist and say, are you able to do at least EGFR and ALK? And in our hands, we have some IHC or immunohistochemical tests that could conceivably come back in 1 or 2 days.
So what happened to this lady?
So we found her RET rearrangement, and it was fortunate that at the time we had a phase 2 study of a RET inhibitor, cabozantinib, that we had very quickly mounted, I want to say about half a year after these fusions were first described in late 2011 or early 2012. So cabozantinib is a multi-tyrosine kinase inhibitor with activity against RET, VEGFR2. She went on the trial and had a very brisk clinical response. So if you remember, she had a large pleural effusion. A Pleurix was in place that was actively draining. She went on cabozantinib, and within a week, the amount of fluid that was coming out of the Pleurix had decreased to zero. She also had a substantial improvement in shortness of breath. And we got her to our first scan at 4 weeks, which showed a fantastic response. So she had a partial response with 70% shrinkage of her disease burden. And that was actually maintained for a total of 2 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
What happened after 2 years?
So after 2 years, she developed progression of disease, and I had sequenced her. So remember, she hadn't had any therapy for her lung cancer apart from cabozantinib. I started first-line therapy with carboplatin, pemetrexed, and bevacizumab.
And what's your current situation?
So she's doing well. She's responded again to first-line chemotherapy. And there is data showing that, like in ALK rearranged lung cancers that can be potentially more sensitive to pemetrexed-based therapies, we've shown that RET rearranged lung cancers can also be very sensitive to pemetrexed. And this was a retrospective series, but within the limitations of that, the response rate was about 48% to pemetrexed-based systemic therapy in RET rearranged lung cancers.
So you had some data presented, I guess, from the trial she was on at the recent ASCO meeting looking at cabozantinib. It looks like about 20 patients. What did you see there?
Right. So the first stage of this phase 2 trial was completed, and that was a total of 16 patients. And we found that the response rate was approximately 40%. The progression-free survival with cabozantinib was about 7 months with an overall survival median of about 10 months. And this brings up the question, well, you said it was a driver, but you're seeing responses in 40% of patients. That's certainly not the situation with EGFR-targeted therapy in EGFR and ALK-targeted therapy in ALK fusions. And I think that there are several possible explanations. One, this may be speaking to the biology of RET rearrangements, because we know that for BRAF mutant lung cancers, for example, with single agent BRAF inhibition, the response rate is also about 30%. So there may be a bucket for EGFR mutations and ALK fusions with a 60 to 80% response rate, and another biologic bucket, which may include BRAF mutations and RET, where we're seeing lower efficacy with single agent targeted therapy. But the flip side is that we also may just need a better drug. And that brings up the fact that many patients on this trial did need dose reductions along the course of their therapy. So 2/3 of them had to go down from the initial dose of 60 milligrams daily to 40 or 20 milligrams. And this patient in particular did require dose reduction because of LFT abnormalities. And what potential drug we might look for in the future, that might be a more RET-specific inhibitor without a lot of off-target effects that contribute to these side effects, but I think that remains to be seen.
Is there an agent out there like that?
So not in clinical development. I think the closest thing out there to a purer RET inhibitor, maybe with less off-target effects, would be alectinib. And this was based on a paper that was a preclinical paper that was published showing that alectinib, while a good drug for ALK-rearranged lung cancers, also has activity in RET rearrangements.
So you said the response rate was 40%. What did the waterfall plot look like? Did most of these people have drops in the typical thing that you see with targeted therapy, some decrease?
Yep, most people did have disease shrinkage, and the disease control rate was essentially 100%, so there were no primary progressors.
It's interesting that you jumped right into the IPASS model, although we don't have, and I guess we'll never have, a study comparing chemo to, for example, cabozantinib in these patients. And you mentioned she actually did well on chemotherapy. Are there any other alternatives to treating a patient like this who's had a great response with other TKIs out there, RET inhibitors?
Right. And this is a good juncture to talk about other RET inhibitors that are approved for other indications. So if you think to the paradigm in ALK-rearranged lung cancers, where you're able to come in with crizotinib and then follow up with a second ALK inhibitor with almost exactly the same profile of response and potentially the duration of response, we may see a similar situation with RET rearranged lung cancer. So we talked about cabo, which is a multi-tyrosine kinase RET inhibitor. There are other RET inhibitors that are approved for thyroid cancer, like vandetanib and lenvatinib. There is also a drug approved for CML that has activity against RET, and this is ponatinib. And these drugs are also being explored on early phase clinical trials for patients with RET rearrangements.
That's fascinating. Getting back to cabozantinib, we've heard about it from the thyroid people, but also the prostate cancer, where there was a lot of interest. And it kind of, the things I heard weren't all that great in terms of quality of life. What about this lady? You mentioned she had transaminitis. Any other symptoms or side effects from the treatment?
She did. So she had transaminitis and with the 60 milligrams, lots of fatigue. But when she was brought down to 40 milligrams, that was sort of her sweet spot, and she was able to keep on that dose for 2 years. An interesting side effect that maybe not many people bring up is that with chronic daily dosing of cabozantinib, we see hypopigmentation of the skin and the hair. And this is something that happened to this lady predominantly in the skin. So she's of Asian descent, but really has darker skin. And after a year on therapy, her skin looked as if it were bleached.
Wow.
And I had another patient on the trial who was a Caucasian gentleman who had substantial whitening of the skin, but also had shock white hair after about half a year of therapy, when initially he had black hair coming into the trial. And he looked so different that he actually asked us to write a letter that he could bring to the TSA to explain why he didn't look like he did in his driver's license.
Wow. Now, this lady didn't have any changes in her hair?
No. She maintained her hair color. Hard to say because she was also dyeing her hair throughout the process.
Wow.
But certainly her skin looked very different. And now that she's off cabo, her natural color has come back.
Huh. You know, RET sort of sneaked up on us, you know, out in the world there. All of a sudden it was there. And I've heard that it's actually not that rare. What is the actual incidence right now, theoretical, or what do we know about the incidence of this?
Yeah, the quoted incidence is 1% to 2% of unselected cases. But interestingly, in the LCMC, for example, they have looked at testing for both RET and ROS1 and are finding that they're seeing more RET rearranged cases than ROS1 rearranged cases.
Right. That's what I heard, more RET than ROS rearrangements. That's really fascinating.
Yep. So the exact number we don't know, but that experience is echoed at our institution and at two other institutions that have had a conversation about RET testing or screening.
So let's talk about your 81-year-old lady.
Yeah, so this is an 81-year-old female, Caucasian never smoker, who's a retired teacher. She underwent a workup for diverticulitis in 2008 and was incidentally found to have a right upper lobe mass. On CAT scan, this was 1.8 centimeters. And she eventually went on to a surgery for pathologic stage 1A disease. So she had a T1A N0 tumor. because it was a stage 1A lung cancer, so lung adenocarcinoma, she did not receive any adjuvant chemotherapy. And molecular testing at that time was unremarkable for EGFR or KRAS mutation or an ALK fusion. So she presented in 2010, 2 years later, with recurrent disease in lymph nodes in the chest and questionable lesions in the liver. She was still being followed by a local oncologist who decided, because of her age and performance status, to put her on single-agent docetaxel. And the reason for that is unclear, but she poorly tolerated the docetaxel, only got a few cycles, and was subsequently put back on active surveillance and did have relatively stable disease for a year. Unfortunately, at that point, she had further progression in the lymph nodes and in the liver, and then was placed on single-agent pemetrexed with, again, a few months of stable disease.
And that was when you saw her?
That was when I saw her.
What was her condition when you saw her?
So she had felt better on the pemetrexed. We know it's a more tolerable drug compared to Q3-week docetaxel. She did have a substantial amount of fatigue, but nothing that would interfere with her activities of daily living. But because she was a never smoker, we had sent her tissue for next-generation sequencing and had found a mutation in MET. So a specific mutation called the MET exon 14 mutation.
What do we know about that mutation and its clinical phenotype?
This is something that I think we should pay attention to, because in the Cancer Genome Atlas, the incidence of these mutations is about 4%, which is the same frequency overall that we see ALK fusions or rearrangement. So what do these mutations do? They essentially occur at a region on the MET protein, which is the region at which ubiquitination occurs. And in simple terms, when you ubiquitinate a protein, you essentially trash it in the proteasome and get rid of it in the cell. So if you knock out this region of the protein, essentially what happens is you can't trash the MET receptor, and subsequently MET gets floridly overexpressed in these cancers.
Just to clarify, though, I mean, we've also heard about, I think, MET amplification and the use of anti-MET agents, antibodies, and small molecules, correct?
Correct. But the MET-amplified lung cancers, I think, are a distinct population altogether from MET exon 14. Granted, we do see about a 10% overlap between MET exon 14 and MET amplification. Clinically, right now, the MET exon 14 patients, the efficacy of crizotinib is being tested on that same phase 1 trial of crizotinib for ALK and ROS1 that we've heard about.
And what do we know right now about crizotinib and patients with these MET exon 14 mutations?
So our paper that was published in Cancer Discovery was a series of 8 patients with MET exon 14 mutations. 3 of them were treated with crizotinib, and all 3 patients had disease shrinkage.
Was this patient one of them?
This patient was not one of them.
Well, you treated her off study?
Correct. So she did get off-label crizotinib for her MET exon 14 mutation.
And you did that because you'd seen these 3 responses?
Exactly.
Wow.
And she had a wonderful response. So she had about a 40% reduction in her disease burden, and to this day remains on drug at about 8 months since she started therapy.
Wow. How's she tolerating the crizotinib?
According to her, better than the pemetrexed.
Interesting.
So really no side effects except for mild fatigue from the criz.
Did she have the visual thing?
No changes in vision.
Wow, what a story. So I'm just trying to put this whole thing together, because probably for a lot of people, I mean, I guess I'm not the only one. This may be the first time they've heard about this. So you're saying there's a mutation out there that's as common as ALK, 4%.
Correct.
That looks like it responds to crizotinib.
Absolutely. And I think that within the next 1 to 2 years, we'll hear a little more in terms of prospective data on crizotinib or other MET inhibitors in MET exon 14 mutant lung cancers.
So I'll ask naively, is ceritinib a MET inhibitor?
So ceritinib is a great ALK inhibitor, but not all ALK inhibitors are MET inhibitors. Lots of the drugs that we test in the clinic have a variety of targets that can overlap, but they don't all look the same.
Wow, what a story. So that sounds really exciting, and this case sounds really exciting. What would you do with her if she had progressive disease, which hopefully won't happen?
So a number of things. I think that we could consider coming in with another MET inhibitor to see if that would work. She also hasn't exhausted her chemotherapy options. And then there's always the possibility of doing nivolumab or an immune checkpoint inhibitor for her
sure.
at some point.
Absolutely. So I was just thinking, I'm looking at your list of five patients and thinking that 2 years ago, we wouldn't have identified any of these diagnoses.
Right. We've made huge strides in filling out the lung cancer pie.
Yeah, just kind of a commentary on how quickly lung cancer has moved. Every single one of your patients is, we wouldn't even be talking about a couple of years ago. And that moves us on to me, one of the most exciting things in lung cancer right now, patients with BRAF mutations. And you have a 57-year-old man you wanted to present.
Yep. This is a 57-year-old African-American bus driver. Current smoker, so about a 40-pack year history, also with a history of COPD, who presented with right-sided weakness. So he first noticed this while he was driving the bus. He had issues pressing on the brake, and of course, that's a dangerous situation. His handwriting also deteriorated, and eventually this culminated in a fall secondary to a seizure. He was admitted to the hospital, and an MRI was done showing multiple brain metastases. So there were at least 12 brain mets, and the largest of them was 2.6 centimeters. There was substantial mass effect, and he also had imaging of the chest, abdomen, pelvis, which incidentally revealed a 1.3 centimeter right upper lobe mass, right hilar, and mediastinal adenopathy. So in the hospital, Keppra was started, and steroids were started with actually a dramatic improvement in his right-sided weakness. And he first went to the operating room for a left frontal craniotomy to resect his dominant metastasis. After that, postoperatively, he went on to whole brain radiation therapy.
Why did he have the surgery?
It was essentially to address the largest mass, which was causing midline shift. So I know there was a very brisk response to the steroids, but they were concerned about losing control in that area.
Interesting. But he still needed whole brain in addition to that.
He did. He did, because there were multiple other brain mets, so up to 12, like I mentioned earlier. So the pathology from the tumor resection returned as a poorly differentiated adenocarcinoma, but immunohistochemical staining was positive for TTF1 and napsin and negative for P40, so consistent with a primary lung adenocarcinoma. And we had sent off his tumor for molecular testing, so this was a non-NGS test. He had gotten sequenom, and that returned positive for a BRAF V600E mutation.
And I see he was a current smoker?
Current smoker,
wow.
Yes.
Did he stop, incidentally?
He has been trying to stop, but has not succeeded just yet.
Wow. So what happened? You found out he has this BRAF mutation. Then what?
So I had written him for a BRAF inhibitor approved for cutaneous melanomas. This was dabrafenib. And that was early last year in spring of 2014. And he had stabilization of his disease and remains on dabrafenib without tumor growth at about a year and 4 months now.
How's he tolerated treatment?
So he's had lots of cutaneous side effects from the dabrafenib. He, within the first 2 months of dabrafenib therapy, developed hyperpigmented papules or milia on the face. He had also developed corns and calluses on the soles of his feet, potentially from hand-foot syndrome. And so we had roped in our dermatology colleagues to help manage these side effects. Fortunately, he didn't develop a squamous cell carcinoma. He's been followed very diligently by our derm folks.
Yeah, and you've got the oncologic dermatologist there, Dr. Mario Lacouture. I don't know if he actually saw this particular patient.
Mario has been seeing him, yes.
You know, he always comes up with things you never thought about before. I'm sure he's already been involved with dabrafenib and vemurafenib for melanoma. Any sort of tricks you've learned from him about using these drugs in lung cancer?
Absolutely. So for the papules in the cheek, he actually used tretinoin, which is something that I don't routinely use in clinic, but was effective. These papules actually fell off after a while. For the early hand-foot syndrome, in addition to very heavy creams, he had also used salicylic acid. a low dose of salicylic acid, and that certainly helped. This patient also developed cirrhosis, a really dry skin, and Mario had prescribed ammonium lactate.
Now, if you were to see him today, what would you do? And, you know, we saw some data, of course, obviously in melanoma now, we're talking about BRAF inhibitors plus MEK inhibitors. Defactinib, trametinib is the one that's the combination being utilized now. We did see some data on that at ASCO. What did you think about it? And would you do that nowadays? Or what would you do if this man progressed, for example?
We did. So last year, the data on single agent defactinib was presented by Dr. Planchard. And that showed us that the response rate in this phase 2 study was in the order of 30% with a progression-free survival of about 6 months. However, we know from the melanoma experience that if you give a BRAF mutant tumor sort of a two-hit punch, so you hit BRAF and you also hit a downstream effector MEK, that the response rates rise. So you see better efficacy with the addition of a MEK inhibitor. And that was the data that Bruce Johnson presented at ASCO this year. So this was also in the phase 2 setting, and this looked at BRAF mutant lung adenocarcinomas that received the combination of the BRAF inhibitor defactinib and the MEK inhibitor trametinib. And we saw the response rate doubled to about 60%, echoing what we saw in the melanoma space.
So that's the way you're approaching patients nowadays?
Right. So if I saw him today, I would see, first of all, I could get him on a clinical trial where he could get doublet therapy. But if that weren't possible, then I would entertain writing him for defactinib and trametinib and see if we can get coverage for it.
What would you do if he developed, say, slow disease progression, you know, imaging, you're still stable?
So on single agent defactinib, it's a good question because we've had two other patients at our institution with a BRAF V600E. They were put on single agent BRAF inhibition. And on progression, we decided to come in and add on the MEK inhibitor. And both of these patients, again, responded to drug with several months of disease control. So it's possible that if you come in with BRAF inhibitor on progression, you might be able to get more efficacy if you layer on a MEK inhibitor.
So let's talk about your 50-year-old lady.
This is a 50-year-old never-smoker psychiatrist with no real past medical history who presented in 2011 with cough, fevers, and shortness of breath. She had an X-ray, showed a right pleural effusion. A CAT scan confirmed the pleural effusion, but in addition, revealed multiple pleural-based metastases. She had gone for a VATS procedure and a biopsy of one of these pleural-based mets, and that was positive for metastatic adenocarcinoma, consistent with a lung primary based on the IHC profile. And testing at that time was performed via our former non-NGS algorithm, and she had no mutation in EGFR, rearrangement of ALK, KRAS mutation, or BRAF mutation. So it was decided to put her on first-line systemic chemotherapy with cisplatin, pemetrexed, and bevacizumab. She did well and responded, and so was subsequently transitioned to maintenance pemetrexed and bevacizumab. However, after a while, later in 2012, developed lots of fatigue, and maintenance therapy was discontinued, and she was placed on active surveillance. Around that time, we had sent her tumor for testing for ROS1, which, if we look back to the development of these different tests, was a test that came in later than EGFR, ALK, and KRAS. And lo and behold, it was positive for a ROS1 rearrangement. The ROS1 rearrangement was later confirmed on next-generation sequencing, and we had the phase 1 crizotinib trial up and running at our institution. She enrolled onto the trial, very quickly had a partial response with more than 60% shrinkage of her tumor, and she stayed on crizotinib for a total of 2 years. And I think that's very interesting. So if we look back to the data for crizotinib in ROS1 rearranged lung cancers that was presented, the response rate was 70%, but the progression-free survival was approaching 2 years, so 22 months. And if you think back to ALK rearranged lung cancers and the efficacy of crizot, that's more than double, what we are seeing in the Alkria range space. So to me, this speaks to possibly the biology of ROS1 rearranged lung cancers and the fact that they can have much more durable and long-lasting disease control with crizotinib.
So what happened after the 2 years?
Later in her course, she developed new small brain metastases on the crizotinib. And unfortunately, we were worried about losing control. So at that point, she did require whole brain radiation. Didn't really have substantial side effects from that. But at the 2-year mark, did develop widespread progression of disease with increasing bilateral pulmonary nodules, retroperitoneal adenopathy, and interestingly, peritoneal carcinomatosis, which we do see in patients with lung cancer occasionally. So she was then transitioned to a phase 2 trial of cabozantinib, which incidentally, and we've talked about how lots of targeted therapies for lung cancer have multiple targets. So cabozantinib also turns out to be a very good ROS1 inhibitor. And she again developed a durable partial response. So this time 92% disease shrinkage. And she's been on drug now for approaching a year since we initiated therapy.
Wow, what a story. How's she tolerating the cabozantinib?
So she also required dose reduction. She's now down to 20 milligrams. For her, it was mostly nausea and fatigue. But this brings us to the fact that like ALK-rearranged lung cancers, and we spoke about this previously, where you can come in with a second ALK-directed TKI, in the ROS1 rearranged space, there are second-generation ROS1 inhibitors and other ROS1 inhibitors, probably with a different binding mode, that can be effective after you develop acquired resistance to crizotinib.
What are some of the more promising agents?
So there are a few second-generation ROS1 inhibitors like ceritinib, brigatinib, and entrectinib that are being tested. So these are drugs with potentially increased potency and sensitivity for ROS. However, I think something that we have to watch out for in the rearranged lung cancer space is what particular acquired resistance mechanism patients develop when their tumors learn to become resistant to crizotinib. And Alice Shaw had published a paper in the New England Journal of Medicine showing that they can develop a solvent front mutation. So this was a G2032R mutation, not a gatekeeper mutation. So a solvent front mutation that, in simple terms, kicks out the crizotinib. And so it's less able to effectively bind and inhibit ROS1. And there are two drugs that can potentially inhibit solvent front mutations. So cabozantinib is one of them. And incidentally, this lady, we did biopsy her tumor on progression with crizotinib and found a solvent mutation. But there's also a PF0646-3922 that's currently in clinical testing that has activity.
Wow. Let's finish out talking about your patient with the HER2 mutation, the 63-year-old lady.
Yeah, so 63-year-old female Asian fashion designer with a 40-pack year former smoking history. She had quit 20 years prior, who presented in late 2012 with a non-productive cough. X-ray showed a lung mass. CAT scan revealed a 5.2 centimeter left infrahilar mass and increased left hilar adenopathy. So she had a clinical stage 2B, T2B N1M0 lung cancer. She eventually went on to a surgery, and because of the position of her tumor, required a left pneumonectomy and a mediastinal lymph node dissection, and was upstaged to a T2A N2, so she had positive mediastinal disease. She then had her tumor sent for molecular profiling and was found to have a HER2 point mutation in her tumor.
And how was she managed?
So she had appropriately received adjuvant chemotherapy for her stage 3 disease and postoperative radiation therapy. And fortunately, we knew that she had the HER2 mutation after she had gotten definitive therapy, and she was thereafter followed and presented with recurrent disease to the liver and lymph nodes. And she was subsequently enrolled onto a phase 2 trial of a HER2-directed tyrosine kinase inhibitor. Had a very good response to therapy and remains on treatment at about 7 months.
And I see here it was a trial of neratinib. Is the thinking that in contrast to HER2 amplification that's seen in breast cancer, that these HER2 mutations are more sensitive to TKIs than antibodies?
So not necessarily. So for lung cancers, HER2 mutations have been overall disappointing in terms of their response to single agent HER2 TKIs. So it's worth mentioning that there are two major buckets of HER2 mutations in lung adenocarcinomas. The most common bucket are the HER2 exon 20 insertions. And this lady falls into the second bucket. She had a point mutation. We have seen some activity with afatinib, dacomitinib, which are TKIs with HER2 activity. And also retrospectively, there's been one case of a response to trastuzumab. But again, not huge efficacy that we've noticed with single agent HER2-directed targeted therapy.
So again, now this lady had already received some prior therapy. But first of all, if you have a patient who has a HER2 mutation, do you consider the use of, say, a TKI? I guess afatinib, maybe you mentioned, at least that's approved. It sounds like lapatinib, maybe not. Is that what you were referring to before?
Right. So to my knowledge, there haven't been any lung cancer responses with a HER2 mutation to lapatinib. There was a very small case series of 3 patients with a HER2 mutation that responded to afatinib. So it was a quote-unquote 100% response rate. But frankly, we've used these agents in clinic, and the efficacy has been a little disappointing. I, for one, haven't seen a substantial amount of efficacy with afatinib. There was one other patient, and this brings up a point which I want to discuss regarding HER2 mutant lung cancers, who my colleague started on a HER2 TKI and trastuzumab, who did have a good response to therapy. And I think that in the HER2 mutant lung cancer space, we may have to think about combinatorial therapy. If you look to the breast cancer experience, these agents are either approved in combination, so trastuzumab and lapatinib, or the TKI with chemotherapy, so lapatinib and capecitabine, for example, or trastuzumab and capecitabine. Is it possible that the biology of HER2 mutant lung cancers lends itself to a similar situation where you not only need the targeted therapy, but either doublet targeted therapy or targeted therapy plus a chemotherapeutic agent?
Yes, certainly lapatinib, trastuzumab is a commonly used therapy in metastatic breast cancer. Actually, there was some data in colon cancer at ASCO, but this is HER2 amplified, but still with some good responses to that combination. Bottom line is, for a general oncologist in practice, if they pick up a HER2 mutation, do you think it's rational to try to give some kind of anti-HER therapy off trial?
I think so. I think that if you're going to decide to come in with a single agent HER2-directed therapy like trastuzumab or a TKI, I would advocate looking very early, so say at 4 weeks, to see if the patient's responding or not. And at that point, consider adding on a second agent like chemotherapy. But for many of these patients, I think that if you have access to a good clinical trial exploring an exciting HER2-directed therapy, then that's something to certainly look into.
What do we know about the incidence of HER2 mutations in different tumor types? I know you actually see this in breast cancer, much less commonly than amplification. What other cancers are HER2 mutations seen in?
Yeah, so in breast cancers, the rate of HER2 amplification of overexpression is close to 20%. But as you mentioned, the mutation rate is really a tenth of that, so it's about 2%. For mutations, HER2 mutations in lung cancer, the incidence is between 2 to 4%, so not a big slice of the pie. We do see amplification, HER2 amplification in lung cancers, and that's about 3%. But we, in ASCO this year, presented a series where there was no overlap between HER2 amplified and HER2 mutant tumors. And we think that probably these are biologically distinct populations.
So again, for HER2 amplified lung cancer, would you consider non-protocol use of anti-HER therapy, and which kind of therapy?
I think that if you wanted to play it safe, I would do HER2-directed therapy with chemo. So consider doing it with a taxane, for example.
So like trastuzumab.
Trastuzumab with a taxane, exactly.
That makes sense. What about other cancers? Are there other cancers that have HER2 mutations?
So there's some thought of reliance to HER2 in gastric cancers. but the exact incidence of HER2 mutations I'm not aware of. These are probably found at low incidence in other solid tumors, but I'm not aware that they've been explored to the extent that they've been explored in breast cancer or even in lung cancer, even though we have very little data.